Today is Thursday. It's January 28th, 2021. It's 1:39 in the afternoon. And hi, I'm John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record every week via Zoom. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the delightfully bored columnist from the Tribune.
That kind of sucks not having you-know-who doing you-know-what, right, Eric?
I know. I was saying we gotta get him back in the public eye to save podcasting.
By the way, better all podcasts go away than you know who comes back. We talked about this briefly last week. You just had another 7 days of the temperature is down 80%.
It may be, but I think that we are sort of seeing the tectonic plates sort of move in a way that I guess I don't know how they'll settle. But I think we're now sort of seeing some of the Republicans settle in and figure out that they're going to carry the torch. We've got Kevin McCarthy, Republican congressman down in Florida, trying to make amends after blasting Trump. I feel like we're still going to have the remnants of that and the disruption.
Yeah.
And we've got this congresswoman, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is, at least in part, a QAnon devotee. So I don't know that the hangover is going to be completely over for a while.
Yeah, well, it's not like there's no news. I totally agree that there's lots of news. It's just that when you have a president who, like Joe Biden, who is sort of normal and has a news conference and answers questions and doesn't brag about his election victory or who just sort of manages to go through a day when you don't feel like you have to keep checking, you know, Google News and NPR and WGN to find out what fresh hell has just been unleashed upon us.
Yeah,
there's lots of stuff going on, and the impeachment trial should be pretty darn interesting. I hope they get rid of Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's all kinds of stories, obviously, but I mean, just when you compare it to how I felt anyway up until the 20th of this month, great sense of relaxation.
In the past, I would get up and go, okay, what's going to happen or what happened in the last 24 hours out of Washington? The last couple of days, I woke up and I went, okay, if I had a stock, but I didn't buy it, but then I sold it, and I'm trying, like, what? All my brain power has been sucked up by that stupid topic. First, let's go back to Chicago and Illinois. You guys may remember I was a minor celebrity last summer when I revealed that I had the coronavirus antibody, that I once had COVID-19. But in time, everybody, it turns out, knew someone, if they or a family member didn't themselves have the virus. COVID deaths, I think, have had a similar arc. You didn't know anyone. Now you probably do know someone who has died with the virus. And today, it's, I'd say, the vaccine. You probably haven't received it, but you may know someone who has. And for most Illinoisans, this vaccine story is really frustrating right now. The distribution is not coordinated. The information out there reminds me of how the state's Department of Employment Security handled unemployment checks. Mm-hmm. In each case, you're told, be patient, believe us, in time you'll get yours, but that doesn't offer much consolation, you know, right now.
Yeah, the state and the city really, both having responsibilities for that. I think after a pretty strong start, which we talked about on this podcast, we've seen Illinois slip behind a lot of the nation. If you look, the New York Times has that great tracker of all 50 states and the percentage of the population that's been vaccinated. We're not doing well relative to our peers. And there is a fantastic piece by Hannah Meisel in NPR Illinois around a dispute between the governor's office and Walgreens CVS. And it gets to this. And the sense there is that there's a lot of finger pointing being done by the governor. And there's clearly a case here that she outlines where you had an activation date for CVS and Walgreens to be going into skilled nursing facilities on December 28th. But for assisted living facilities, and again, these are the highest, most vulnerable people. These are older folks in these congregate settings. That date, activation date for the assisted living facilities was January 25th, which was the latest in the nation. And Hannah goes to CVS and Walgreens, and they say, yeah, the governor's office told us this was the date. And the governor's office goes back and says, no, that was CVS and Walgreens. They were pushing it back. And this is exactly the same thing we saw with IDES. We are a year into heightened unemployment claims due to COVID almost. And IDES is still a mess. They're still finger pointing. There's been very little accountability at the state level for the poor performance there. Timeliness of benefits.
IDES is invisible.
It's abysmal.
Pardon me. I just can't help but double down on that. IDES has been invisible. It's been, I think, a huge fail on the state's part.
Well, the problem with IDES, they did bring in a new director. I think it was in August to try to fix things. And I keep hearing from people the same sort of problems that we were hearing before that, which is that they have a callback system, but the callbacks don't happen for a really long time. And then sometimes you'll get a callback when you're driving or you can't answer the phone, and then you can't get back to them. All kinds of problems that somebody needs to crack heads and make it work. The same thing is true, it seems to me, with this vaccine problem, where you've got all this finger pointing of CVS, Walgreens. No, it's the governor. No, and the governor's pointing to Walgreens and CVS and the federal government. And everyone is like accusing one another of doing this rather than everyone being on the same page. And we're very new in the Biden administration, but they need badly to take control of this from the federal level and make sure that there are a bunch of standards that are being applied, because right now it does seem like a complete mess.
You know what I did? We posted on our station's webpage. I'm sure Channel 11 did this too, Heather, but we said, okay, if you live in these counties, here's where to go to sign up for the vaccine. Here's the state one as well. Here's the city of Chicago, every kind of geographic boundary. And then we did it for the various drugstores and stores too. None of them are the same. You don't know which one you should be on. There's no coordination. Some of them are pretty easy. Some of them actually don't let you sign up.
There are two issues. One is that the supply is less than the city can handle. So the city is getting somewhere between 34 and 34,000 first doses of the vaccine every week. But the city could handle 170,000 doses of the vaccine every week. So that is part of the bottleneck. The other bottleneck is that Chicago gets a separate vaccine allocation from the state. So the federal government sends two vaccine allocations to Illinois, one to the state and one to the city of Chicago Health Department. And the city of Chicago has just a disproportionate number of healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents who are eligible in 1A, which is why that you've not seen the city be able to open up appointments at their mass vaccination sites for anyone other than healthcare workers at this point. So that's the big bottleneck in the city. And that is sort of what the issue in the city is. But the fact of the matter is that the state says, look, we're sending out, you know, as much as we can to get to people. But the plan developed by the Trump administration really put the onus on the state and the local health departments to figure out how to get this vaccine into people's arms, while at the same time responding to COVID-19, while doing a massive testing, while operating a massive testing operation. So I don't think it's a surprise, or it shouldn't be a surprise to any of us, that this vaccination effort has been less smooth than I think anybody would have wanted. I think that it's really hard to sort of pin the blame directly on what's happening. Although I read Hannah's story too and was just like, that's an interesting hiccup right there. But we've seen in other states that the states are pulling back those vaccine doses from that federal partnership with Walgreens and CVS because they have also been slow in those states. And West Virginia is the best vaccinated state, and they didn't partner with the federal government on that. So there's some nexus between that program and a delay in vaccines. It's not entirely clear to me sort of exactly what it is, but I'm telling you, it's extremely frustrating. My mom is over 65. I have now been disinherited and will no longer speak to her because I said that on a podcast. But I'd like to get her an appointment and I can't. You know, I've tried Walmart, I've tried Walgreens, yeah. I've tried Jewel Osco, I've tried anywhere I could think, and it just hasn't happened yet. Now, she's only been eligible for the vaccine for 4 days, but it's a level of frustration that I think a lot of people are feeling, and there are no good answers about when it's going to get significantly better. Now, that said, the state and the city will get 16% more vaccine doses next week under a new plan announced by the Biden administration, but that's like 5,000 more doses.
West Virginia used their National Guard to distribute it. And I'm glad you point that out. It's hard to figure out who to point at. Think about this. If we were getting 160,000 doses delivered and ready to go into arms and had an efficient mechanism, there'd still be a lot of people angry and waiting. There'd still be long, real and virtual lines. I mean, there's millions of us here. So I wonder if some of this is inevitable. Does it sound like we're piling on? They're doing the best they can and these criticisms aren't warranted?
Well, there's blame to be laid at the feet of the federal government for sure. I mean, of course, as Heather described, there's a bottleneck there. The Illinois side of things, though, that I think about is exactly the Ides example. In a crisis, it's become clear that the state of Illinois is really, really terrible in terms of whether it's headcount, leadership, administration of the program. The quality of services is not good. And that's true even in non-COVID times, but is especially made apparent when there's a crisis at hand. And that's really frustrating.
Well, I would say that IDES, my understanding was that it was going along pretty well before the COVID crisis hit. There weren't a lot of problems with it. In fact, that it was an agency that had been kind of neglected because it wasn't making a lot of noise. And it was completely unprepared, which you would understand. And I think all of us, at least I certainly would give them some slack on the fact that right away they're hit with, you know, an incredible multiple of the number of claims. But as Austin points out, it's been a year now almost, and they've had plenty of time to ramp up, change their system, get it together. And again, with the vaccines, I don't know how much time you can really give them, given that it's been sort of a shit show getting it going here. Is there a way we can say, okay, well, by Valentine's Day, if this isn't smoothed out, if it isn't obvious and systematized and set up so that we can get our shots, we know where to go and it's easy to do and you don't have to be a teen computer genius to get a shot, say, well, that's a hiccup. But is it going to be more than a hiccup? Is it going to be a chronic bellyache?
Well, do you, Eric, does anybody know anybody who's gotten the vaccine personally?
A friend of ours is a pediatrician. I know she got it. And another friend of mine works for the University of Chicago Health System. She's not a physician.
Outside of the health community. Outside of a 1B, if you will. Does anybody know a 1B that got it? Heather, you're shaking your head. A friend of mine did, but he described it like trying to get concert tickets years ago. You get multiple browsers up and you start slamming every site you can and one of them hits. Woohoo, I'm in. I got two. Lisa, you've had no luck at your house. Nobody got the vaccine?
Nobody's gotten the vaccine yet, no. We have family in Maine, and they're already on, we have some elderly relatives, I should say, and they were close.
What should the consequence be to teachers that don't go back?
I don't think there should be a consequence to the teachers who don't go back. Again, this is something where I think we need to give them a little more time. We need to get vaccines in arms. I understand, as I've said before on this podcast, I understand their fears, their reluctance to go back in a time, especially when we've got this new strain of the virus out there. I know that the Principals Association, these are people who really do know how their schools are running and are very in tune with both the parent community and the teachers community. The Principals Association is pretty much opposed to going back the way things are right now. So I think that declaring a strike and pulling the teachers out of these virtual classrooms would be a mistake.
So many of the medical experts are on the other side on that. The CDC, the 17 doctors that sent a letter to the Sun-Times, Kevin Most that was on our show, Dr. Arwady, they all say the teachers should go back into the classrooms. And it's easy for me to send them back into harm's way because I'm not going in there. But every week, I mean, here we are another week talking about this. Every week that they're fussing about it is another week more people got the vaccine. So I don't want to say it's going to become a moot point, but I think the argument is kind of being made de facto that we can wait. I mean, they're not teaching this week. They probably won't be teaching in the classrooms next week. So maybe CPS just needs to take the lump. You know, they fought the good fight. They think they should be in there, but they're not going to win this one. Students aren't showing up and the teachers don't want to go.
It's a bit of a sad statement, given that we have elected officials that we all voted on to have control of our public schools. The Chicago Teachers Union was not elected by any of us. They were elected by education employees, and they have every right to say what they want and have opinions about these things. But I think this attitude of like, well, CTU, I guess, is going to win again. I mean, this would be, what is it, their fourth strike in 9 years and their second in 2 years? At what point does this become a really vicious, toxic cycle where whatever CTU leadership wants, they can command the entire body of public education in Chicago to come to its knees? I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's good for teachers. I don't think it's good for students. I don't think it's good for parents. And it speaks again to this whole issue of quality of services. People in Illinois have become used to this terrible quality of services. And this is another example of that, I think.
Well, the mayor said, you know, and this is more than about education. Do you want to live in Chicago and send your kids to a Chicago public school, even a good one, if every year they're probably going to strike? It just, talk about the quality of living. People are worried about carjackings, let alone are their kids going to get 9 straight months of an education?
Neither the mayor nor the union agree on the facts. So the mayor and Janice Jackson are saying it's safe. We promise we've done all of this work and we, you know, are doing our best. And, you know, we want to get kids back in school, but the union just has less than zero belief that they are treating that information is accurate. And they believe that the school district would be willing to sort of sacrifice their health and the health of their families to sort of make this happen. And so when you have that sort of, you know, state, it's almost impossible to develop a policy because you don't agree on the facts. So that's where it's been since the beginning of this effort to get kids back in school. And that's where we are today. And I don't see any reason why we're not there on Monday when, you know, approximately 70,000 elementary school students are supposed to go back for the first time since March 2020.
Think about that.
So that, I think, is a legacy of really the just tense relationship between the union and the mayor that developed during the campaign when the union supported Tony Preckwinkle over Lori Lightfoot. But it's also a legacy of how both sides handled that 2019 strike. And I think a lot about how the mayor, after a deal was reached, said that she would not sort of end the dispute unless the teachers agreed to give up several days of pay that they had been on strike for. Now, in the past, those days had always been made up for teachers, but the mayor drew that line in the sand. And it's really hard to overstate what a bad taste that left in the union's mouth.
Boy, I haven't thought about that in a long time. You think that lingers, huh?
Well, I think it absolutely does. And I think the fact that the mayor has basically said, if you don't do this, you're not protecting our children or you're letting our Black and brown children fall further behind. I think that also sort of has, you know, sort of amped up the rhetoric in a way that's made it more difficult for both sides to sort of figure out what the facts are that they can all agree on. Now, the problem is that there are no real facts that everybody agrees on. Like, there's no sort of CDC guideline that says, yes, schools are safe under these exact circumstances. And if you meet these circumstances, it's safe. And if you don't, it's not safe.
Well, you make a good point talking about school districts all around the country, Heather, because Chicago's situation is making national news headlines. And when that's happening, you're realizing that our teachers are not handling things the way they're handling them in other big cities, that there is something going on here that goes beyond just routine concerns about health. Now, I thought that the CDC was fairly explicit about the fact that you could open schools under certain conditions, but you're saying that that's very vague what they say.
Right. Are you talking test positivity? Or are you talking case positivity? You know, typically the idea is that it's relatively safe if the pandemic is in good control, which means a test positivity of less than 5%. The city's test positivity is 6.6%. And in some neighborhoods, especially on the west side, the test positivity is double than that. So are you going to go, does the CDC want you to go by the city's test positivity rate or a zip code's, you know, positivity rate? Or are you talking about just like a school's positivity rate? Nobody knows the answers to those questions. So if you are starting from a place of sort of mutual distrust and animosity, it makes it impossible to figure out sort of what those standards should be.
Well, not knowing all of the facts or the points upon which they would come to agreement, couldn't we just say, wear 2 masks, put the kids 6 feet apart, have half the kids in the classroom, keep the teacher on one end of the classroom? I mean, there's just the obvious things you can do. And what I hear is that'll work. That will work.
Yeah, I would think that would be especially true in older classrooms. I think when you have younger kids, I think you have to be much closer to them. It's a more tactile experience teaching younger kids. But if you're a high school history teacher, it seems to me like you could keep 6 feet away from your students and you could have air purifiers in your room and everyone could be wearing masks.
There's no proposal to get high school students back in school in Chicago. Like that is not even on the horizon. So we're not even talking about that. Like that's the fall, essentially. But we're talking about elementary school students because the mayor's point is well taken, is that the kids that are struggling the most are those less able to learn remotely. And by and large, high school students have had an easier time than kindergartners. So that's why there's been this emphasis on preschool and elementary.
Well, we've completely forgot about bringing high schoolers back to public school, but in private school, a lot of them are going back. I mean, there's 20,000 kids at parochial schools in Chicago who have been going to in-person classes on a semi-regular basis throughout this, and it hasn't been linked to community spread. Eric made a really important point here about the national coverage, and I think back to the 2012 CTU strike, which they proudly display an article about in Vox that inspired strikes in West Virginia, in Arizona, in California. This is a very similar situation where they want to draw a line in the sand to rally the rest of the most radical action possible from teachers unions and other places in the United States. And I think it's important to recognize that. And that was exactly the strategy in 2012. I think a key point about the agreeing on the facts is CPS is certainly not blameless in any of this. I cannot imagine CTU ever coming to the table and saying, yes, we agree with you, Lori Lightfoot, let's do it. You know, like it's just not going to happen. If they think that there's an unsafe working environment, there's a process in Illinois law by which they can file a complaint to say that. You take it to the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board and you say, this is an unsafe working environment, we want to strike. They're not doing that because the result is not going to come in their favor. It would be illegal. They're not under a current collective bargaining agreement. That would not go in their favor. And instead, they are just going to extract maximum pain on Lori Lightfoot. And I don't think that serves the interests of hardly anybody.
But they're not asking for like combat pay or anything, right? I mean, this is not a shakedown of any sort. So the motivation, malign motivation that we're imputing to them is what?
To set a line in the sand for all other teachers unions in big cities throughout the nation. And to extract, show Lori Lightfoot who's boss.
Austin, that would be secondary. I mean, that's not why teachers are deciding to put their careers on the line to help teachers unions in West Virginia, right?
No, I'm talking about, and I should be very clear about this, union leadership. I think rank and file teachers, and I think that's not representing the best interests oftentimes of rank and file teachers when those political aims are at the forefront.
I'm not an anti-union guy, but I don't think that the police in Chicago are best being served by their union or their union leadership. I want to do, though, segue to something else, which you guys are alluding to a little bit. How does this make Chicago look across the rest of the country? I was talking to a lieutenant with the Chicago Police Department today, and he said that while the carjackings in Chicago are up significantly, up 135% last year, and we're going to have more carjackings at this rate this year. In fact, I did a little back-of-the-envelope math. I think we're on a pace to do about 3,000 carjackings in Chicago this year. In Minneapolis, it's up 500%. In New Orleans, it's up more than it is in Chicago. I don't know what's going on here. I don't know why all of the sudden carjackings are in vogue. Does anybody have an answer for me on that?
Well, one of the articles that I read about it, talked about how wearing masks really enables carjackers because it's not at all unusual to see groups of people wearing masks and all of a sudden they're right up at your car and then they put a gun in your face and they take your car and you can't begin to identify them because you say, well, it was a guy with a mask and he had blue eyes or whatever. And so that makes it really easy. The other theory has to do with the fact that kids are bored. They're not in school.
Yeah.
They don't have anything else to do, and this is a fun thing to do. I haven't read a lot about whether it's connected to the kind of car theft that you would see in a normal year where you'd have cars that are stolen and then chopped up and so on.
Yeah, that is part of it. Some of it is part of that, but some of it is part of sort of tied to the other crimes that we're seeing where people, like you said, Eric, you know, there's a little bit of freedom with the mask. And so they're using it to commit other crimes. But part of it is, I was surprised to read that because what was it back in the early aughts or the maybe even the 90s when there were these rings of people sort of, you know, chopping up cars, but that is part of it. Jeremy Gorner had that in a piece, I believe last week or earlier this month, about that was that figured into it.
That it's a chop shop thing going on?
There's some chop shop stuff going on. Yeah, they're parting out cars and selling out, you know.
When I talked to Chicago police about this, maybe a couple months ago now, they told me that something like 90 to 95% of these cars are recovered pretty quickly, and which is one reason why if someone wants your car, just give it to them, because the odds are quite good that you'll get it back. Don't try to shoot it out with them. I guess they're also taking when they pull people out of their cars, they take their phones and their wallets and so on as well. So that might be part of it. It might actually just be kind of an excuse. It's a way to get the material and then get out of there without giving the person a chance to give chase.
Yeah, you got a getaway car right there. Yeah,
and they can't call the police until they can get to somebody with a cell phone. I don't. It is clearly a crime of opportunity. Our friend Dolly Glanton had a piece this week in the Tribune arguing against a crackdown on carjackers, and I wasn't persuaded by it because I feel like, you know, her. She made some good points about the fact that this is, you know, these kind of crimes are related to some broader pathologies in some of these neighborhoods and among some of these populations that we need to address. But there was also, I believe it was in her story, certainly there was another story where some kids were caught. I mean, I want to say it was Addison. They were caught doing this, and then the mm-hmm. cops chased them into the city and brought them back. And while they were bringing them back, they were telling the cops, they were saying, we're just going to get bonded out tomorrow. We're going to come back up here and kill you or something like that. So the insouciance that these kids have about getting arrested, they don't seem to care because they're not getting punished because there aren't big crackdowns. The odds of getting caught seem really, really small, and the consequences for getting caught are small. And you know, I think that you need to crack down on it. I think you need to increase the penalties for things like this. Otherwise, it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, Darlene said the opposite. She said you will just train these kids to be hardened criminals if you keep them in jail longer. I'll tell you what, my phone lines light up with people. When this story comes up, I didn't say, do you think this is Kim Fox's problem? But boy, oh boy, this segued very quickly to Kim Fox. Is that fair, guys?
This carjacking was a big issue under Rahm Emanuel for a couple of months, and that they went to Springfield with Eddie Johnson. They said, we need more laws to put these, you know, criminals behind bars. And it went nowhere, and the carjackings eventually stopped, right? They returned to sort of normal levels. So that says to me that this is not necessarily sort of a systematic law enforcement sort of prosecution problem, but that it's driven by sort of facts on the ground and other issues. Whether it's true or not, I think you're not going to find the kind of support that you would a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago for somebody saying, lock these people up. You're just not. I think it's a different world post George Floyd and post the protests.
I have a question here more than a comment to that end, too. I don't know that they're not prosecuting. I haven't seen the data on this. I've heard the argument, let's get tougher on this. But I haven't seen the data that supports that people are not being held accountable when they are arrested and convicted of these crimes. They mm-hmm. are violent crimes. Mm-hmm. If you do have a juvenile, yes, I don't think that the juvenile system is going to change if that's what we're talking about. But I so far haven't seen any evidence that they're getting quote unquote off the hook. I've heard that argument. I've heard the gripe. I don't know where that data is.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm making it sound like it's the truth. The truth is that's the perception. So if it's not the truth, they ought to get in front of that. But hopefully they are prosecuting these cases to the fullest extent of the law. And I don't know. But the deputy superintendent that was on our station today very quickly tossed it into Kim Fox's court. He said, you know, we need to get more prosecution out of the county.
It seems like a de facto sort of everything is every. This seems to be sort of that everything is becomes her fault when, you know,
yes, it does.
People have sort of this idea that people need to be, people are charged. And then there is a process. I'm not giving her a break. I'm not trying to be hard on her either. her team is charged with charging people and yes, prosecuting people, but there are juries and judges and there's a wider universe of the criminal justice system than just Kim Fox. And again, I don't know where the evidence is that shows that she's no longer prosecuting.
Well, there's a passage in a Tribune story from the other day, and it says that there have been 166 carjackings in 2021 so far. So it's less than a month, a little less than a month. 108 arrests, but 58 of those arrestees have been charged only with misdemeanor trespass to a vehicle.
And I saw that, and I kind of wondered.
Small sample size. What?
I didn't have any perspective for that. I wondered whether those were something different, because usually sort of the trespass is either somebody getting into the vehicle or, you know, it's something shy of a burglary where you actually take something. You're not just sort of getting into the car, but you're taking something. So I wondered about that.
Misdemeanor trespass of a vehicle seems to me like, you know, some kid is going down the street and there's a car door that's open and he sees this change on the dashboard and or in the console, and he goes in and they catch him. So that's a misdemeanor. A carjacking, which usually takes place at gunpoint and it results in an auto theft. I mean, maybe there's a categorical error here, but and I do understand what Darlene was saying in her column about, you know, you prosecute these kids, you put them into prisons, and prisons are kind of monster factories. That's all true, but that actually argues for perhaps more investment in better incarceration, better detention, better justice system investments, rather than just saying, well, we can't lock them up. So I don't know. I mean, that seems to be, you know, fairly obvious to me that you need to address this in a tough way, but also a smart way. And that just saying, well, don't lock them up is not going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good point. And the dichotomy that Darlene was sort of playing in was, well, there's a bunch of people on one side saying you have to charge the juveniles as adults, because if you don't, there's no consequences. And so I was looking this up. In 2020, there were 1,400 reported carjackings in Chicago, 188 arrests, 106 of those arrests were juveniles. So it's clearly either, you know, there are older people telling younger people they can do this and get away with it, or something of that nature. Like, there's clearly some incentives at play that are making this a crime that's more common to be done by people who are young. There's a great over in North Lawndale at UCAN, a restorative justice court that is specifically for juveniles. The last I checked, that was actually the only restorative justice court for juveniles in possibly the county, maybe just the city. They've had great results there. And the purpose there is to say, well, it's not a choice between lock you up as an adult or no consequences as a juvenile. There is some sort of process by which there are consequences and some kind of learning that takes place after a crime has been committed. And that seems to me like one piece of the puzzle that should be explored more.
Well, why are they doing it? Is it joyrides? Are they using the vehicles as ways to commit a crime and then dump the vehicle thereafter? And the victims of carjackings just must carry that for the rest of their lives and make them so less inclined to come into the city. I don't know if I mentioned this to you guys. I know Eric and I were talking about it off the air, but somebody got mugged on the red line in front of me a couple weeks ago, and I watched the whole thing play out, and then we hung around and talked to the police and so on and so forth. And so I've been kind of on the CTA and CPD's butt about this, going, why aren't you guys more visible? Why aren't you doing something about this? And they don't have very good answers to my satisfaction. Folks aren't going to come back after the vaccine if they're afraid to come into the city. I suppose I'm a little hyperbolic here, but you know, you want people to come back into town. You got a lot of things working against you. And I don't see us doing many things right. And making people feel safe in this city has to be a priority. And I'm really discouraged by what I'm seeing lately.
For those of us who live here in the city, too, I mean, it needs to be a safe place. I don't know that. I mean, who knows when we're going to go back into our offices at the Tribune. But I mean, I am not going to be able to afford to park downtown. So I will be getting on the CTA again, you know, and doing all of those things.
I ride it every day, Lisa. I take it every day.
To the grocery store and doing what I can sort of on foot, just because I need sort of the sanity walk. But I mean, I am a little bit fearful now of sort of the pre, you know, the 6 a.m. walk now. I'm a little bit skittish about it.
When was the last time you were on it?
The last time I was on the L?
Yeah.
Because I take the bus more often. It's probably been close to a year.
How about you, Austin? When's the last time you were on it?
I think a year. I've biked everywhere, and since it's been wintry, I haven't been going to the office. Everything I've heard about the L is that it's the spookiest place on Earth right now.
It is insane. It is insane. I rode it every day before, and I've been riding it every single day since, except for when I was riding it in the summer. I rode my bike sometimes, but now I'm every day on that damn train. The morning of the mugging, I rode it home.
If any listeners want to meet John Williams, he's the only guy riding the red one.
I'm the only one with a mask, and I'm pissed off about it. Are you kidding me? And you know what we call them now? Sleeper cars. The car comes by, and you go, there's a bunch of people sleeping without their masks, and I'll let that one go. And you're just looking for the safest car, because there's only 12 of you in there anyway. Today it was 20. I count. So thumbs up, we're riding the L. But that's still a lot of empty seats. And if somebody's going to misbehave, you really feel vulnerable. You really feel like you got that red button, and that might make it worse when they see you push it. And even then, it's after the fact now. Somebody's got punched in the meantime. So
there's only one motor operator on the train. There's only one CTA employee on that train, and that's the person who's driving it.
Yeah.
Those sleeper cars are not probably where you're going to find a problem. I mean, you might be annoyed that you can't find a seat, but if homeless people are resting, I mean, that's another social issue. It doesn't tend to be sort of that playing out where somebody who's sleeping on the car gets up and robs somebody. It's somebody who's sort of making tracks from car to car to car, and that's what's going on.
Yeah, you know, that's what happened, by the way, Lisa. Mm-hmm. I let all the sleeper cars go by. I go, okay, nobody's sleeping on this one. Hopped in that one, and we got mugged. So I picked the wrong car.
Oh, you did?
Well, I didn't. Well, so when I tried to intervene, I stood up and I said, hey, because this lady, I thought they were wrestling with her. I said, are you okay? And she goes, no, I'm not okay. And then they tear the phone out of her hand. And so then I kind of step forward, put my arm out, and then the guy taps his breast pocket and says, do you want some of this? And I said, no, I don't need any trouble. The doors opened up. They jumped off. Then I thought, well, I should go chase him and yell police. But I thought, if he really has a gun, I probably should stay in the car. So that's how that ended.
Sorry.
Terrible.
You hear from people who have been carjacked, and it is very, very traumatizing because you're yanked out of your car at gunpoint, and you're asked to hand over your wallet and your keys and your phone, and that's devastating. It's like people who've been broken into have the same thing. When you the sense of violation that lingers with you. You're right, John, and it makes you less likely to want to go where you've gone before. And people talk about not wanting even to drive anymore, not wanting to drive their cars.
I know. How are we going to get friends? So I don't want to drive. I'll get carjacked. I don't want to take public transportation because that doesn't feel right. So I'm going to get on the bicycle with Austin, and we're just going to ride around the city when it's warm. This may sound crazy to you. I'm optimistic. I think people are going to be out in droves this summer, and I will be among them. The third week in July, I still think we're going to be out in numbers. Speaking of downtown, did you guys see the big op-ed in the Tribune about the word Trump on the tower and whether or not that should stay up or come down? And the guy that was arguing for it, he said that we should have the word Trump stay on the tower, even though there's a kind of an ordinance in the works to take it down. He wants it to stay up there as a reminder, right, of what we went through. Does that argument hold water with you guys?
That argument doesn't hold water with me because the sign was approved by the city. He went through the steps you needed to get it on his building. They put it on the building. I don't think you can change the rules on him now and make him take it down. If we had renamed a street for Trump or put a statue of Trump on the public way, I'd be all for getting rid of that. But unfortunately, this is a private building, and it's got a private sign that was legally put up there. The idea of taking it down, of making him take it down, kind of offends me, I have to say.
Yeah. Which is,
you know, back in 2017, the city took down the honorary Trump sign as part of the first wave of Trump outrage. So the city has done what Eric suggested. And not only that, but they changed the rules for honorary signs so that you now have to be dead for 5 years before you get one. And they severely limited the number that aldermen can do every year from infinity to two. So it's already had that fallout has already been felt. I will plead biased on this subject because I grew up walking by the old Sun-Times building, which I adored and have yet to recover from seeing it torn down and replaced.
And as a former Sun-Times journalist who worked in that building, I'm still suffering from losing that building. I miss it terribly. So
was it everybody's favorite?
Go ahead, anyone wants to go down sort of a path to a dystopian hellscape that is Chicago's signage, permitting, and political process, I highly recommend talking with the guys over at Right Way Signs. They do those fantastic painted signs, sort of like Hotel Lincoln has one, Heritage Coffee, they do every cool, the Goose Island Tap Room. There are these beautiful hand painted sign artists. They have to have people full time. Employees on staff just to deal with Chicago's insane rules about signage. And it's one of the most anti-small business rules that we have in the city. It needs to be completely, completely overhauled.
Isn't that an issue for people that even want to put a little awning out, say, on Michigan Avenue, when that Malnati's opened up on the side of the Wrigley building? They just wanted to have a little bit of thing saying we're here. And some people were able to put out tents and some people couldn't. And it was all the somewhat random discretion of their alderman, right?
100%. Yeah. If you are a middle class small business owner in Chicago and you want to even just put an open sign on your business, you better make sure you're not on your alderman's bad side. And that's really sad to say. You go to a city like Phoenix, Arizona, for example, is a 24-hour city. So they pride themselves on saying, hey, if you want to start a business on a Monday, you'll have all of your permitting necessary to do so by a Tuesday if you get us all the stuff that we need. In Chicago, exact opposite mentality. And it hurts poor and middle-class entrepreneurs more than it does rich people like Trump.
Let's just talk for a minute about Lori Lightfoot in general, speaking to the city and how she's doing. I know we've touched on some of her involvement in the schools and the COVID vaccine rollout, et cetera. There's also this business about the mapping.
This dates back to 2019, her Bring in the Light campaign, where she promised to create an independent commission to draw the city's ward boundaries after the 2020 census. So I know Austin knows this, but for those of us who are not nerds listening to this podcast, for years, that process has been run from start to finish by Alderman Ed Burke, who, of course, is awaiting trial and under indictment for 14 counts of corruption and has been mostly sidelined after pleading not guilty. So the question is, how are they going to do it after the 2020 census? And nobody really knows. And even though Mayor Lightfoot said an independent commission is the way to go, she's not reaffirmed that commitment either yesterday or in recent months. And all of this was triggered by a Latino caucus press conference held yesterday that Alderman Roberto Maldonado, the chair, said an independent commission would actually dilute Latino political power in Chicago and that he thinks it should be done the way that it's always been done. Now, Mayor Lightfoot said, no, that's a relic of the past. We shouldn't do it the way that it's always been done. We need to change it. But she definitely didn't endorse an independent commission, which is what she campaigned on. So nobody really knows how this process is going to work. And it's going to be not only very difficult to figure out how to create 50 wards of about 54,000 people each at a time when Chicago is losing African-American population, which, of course, threatens Black political power in Chicago, but also at a time when the results of the 2020 census are very much in question because of things done by the Trump administration, COVID. We're not going to get the data at least until this summer. It's going to be 4 months at least late, which means that it's going to be a very shortened timeline. So if you thought that, you know, the teacher strike in 2019 was a mess, if you thought the mayoral election was a mess, this is going to be just so messy because this will dictate the balance of power in the city council for the next 10 years. And there are a lot of aldermen gearing up to protect their wards.
Hmm. Heather, what is your what is the deadline on this? When do they have to have this done?
So that is a really interesting question. The deadline can be whatever they say the deadline is. And, you know, typically they want to have it in place, you know, a certain amount of time before it goes into effect. But these rules are what the city council says they are. There's no sort of, you know, overreaching sort of, you know, rule that they have to follow. What will happen, though, is that whatever map gets drawn is going to be challenged in court, and it will be up to a judge to eventually say whether they abided by the Voting Rights Act to protect, you know, Black and Latino representation, voting representation. But beyond that, it's a complete and total free-for-all.
Well, are the ward maps in the city as oddly drawn as congressional districts or other kind of, you know, district maps that we've seen, the things Mike Madigan was involved in and so forth?
Well, John, if you turn to page 24 of the New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities, you will see the crab-shaped or lobster-shaped second ward, which used to be that of Bob Fioretti before Rahm and Burke, and I believe Dick Mell got together and drew him out of his ward. And Heather's exactly right. This is only in ordinance, the laws for, and it's very, very vague, the guide rails for passing a new map in Chicago. And it can be changed at the drop of a hat. And you see both with Mayor Lightfoot and with Governor Pritzker, people running on a campaign promise of independent maps. And then when it comes down to it, you've had a chance to pass a constitutional amendment at state level. You had a chance to pass a new ordinance at the city level. They're not interested in doing it. I fully expect it to be a politicized map process if Lightfoot does not come out more strongly and lead with an ordinance.
Austin just held up a picture, which doesn't work on a podcast necessarily, but I've seen that second. That's the second ward, right, Austin, that you're showing us from your book? And
right.
So that's a city aldermanic ward. That's the mother of all preposterous ones in the state, right? Is that the one that is kind of famed for being ridiculous?
I mean, I would say it's the worst of the ward maps, but I wouldn't say that it's, like, you know, much worse than others. I mean, there are, so for example, and I think this is probably the most egregious effect on people's lives, is that the neighborhood of Englewood, the community area of Englewood, is represented by 6 different aldermen. Mm. Now, if you live in Englewood and you have an issue, you have to figure out which one of those 6 aldermen is yours, and maybe the issue that's impacting your life isn't even in the same ward. And that is a real dilution of political power in Englewood, and that has had real impact on people who live in Englewood.
Yeah.
It's had real impact on development in Englewood, because let's say you want to start a business or you want to build something. You say, okay, who's the alderman for Englewood? And you're like, oh man, the property I want is right on the border of, wait, 4 wards? I'm going to go somewhere else, potentially. So that is sort of the driving force behind, create an independent commission. You're not going to have somebody sort of consumed with their political life. They're going to say Englewood should be one ward.
And the reason we're talking about this is that Lori Lightfoot had a chance to say, yes, so let's make more sense out of these maps. Let's have an independent commission. And now she's backing away from that campaign promise. She also had something to say about pot sales on Michigan Avenue this week.
They allowed legal marijuana sales to start in Chicago on January 1st. The rules basically excluded all of the Loop and Michigan Avenue and the downtown area. And Lightfoot said that was necessary because she didn't want to hurt family-friendly, tourist-friendly visits to that area, because she was concerned that allowing pot sales would somehow taint that G-ratedness of Chicago's central business district. Yesterday, Alderman Brendan Riley, who represents the 42nd Ward, which includes downtown, said, let's do away with that ban. We've seen in 6 months or, you know, a year, I guess, that it's been fine, you know, hell has not opened up under these neighborhoods where pots has been sold legally. And Lightfoot basically said, not on my watch, we're not going to allow Michigan Avenue to be transformed into a, quote, pot paradise. And he's, I think, furious with that dismissal of his proposal, especially coming just a couple months after the fact that she pushed aldermen on just the narrowest almost possible vote to improve a property tax increase of almost $100 million, which people will start paying in 2022.
Well, it does seem to me like there's a vast difference between having a marijuana retailer on a street and having it become a pot paradise. I also understand that there's not a lot of evidence from around the country where marijuana is legal that putting up a shop turns a neighborhood seedy or draws a bunch of people hanging out. The people, as far as I understand, they line up to get in, but they don't hang around outside like a liquor store on Skid Row or something. And so it's like, if we're going to legalize and normalize marijuana, which we have done, then I think we need to take that seriously and say, well, look, we have restaurants that serve alcohol on Michigan Avenue. We have liquor stores that are not too far off the drag there. Marijuana emporiums should not be a whole lot different. And they haven't shown themselves to be in the experience here and elsewhere. So I think the mayor's off base on this one.
It felt very arbitrary. I'm not sure what the deal is. The one issue I've heard in talking to people, and something I noticed, is that wherever some of these pot shops are, it slows down traffic. So a lot of people must be driving to these places, and they're double parking and things like that. But it's not sort of people like sort of hanging outside and smoking a bowl and having a party. They're getting their stuff and going. But it seems to me that the traffic is the big deal.
And they're rubbernecking. I think they're rubbernecking. They're going, wow, look at all those people lining up for pot. You know, at the store near us, there's economic development, man. A really nice bakery has opened up. I'm not making this up. On Clark, right next to our pot shop. And there's always
that one. I was going to say, John, that one on Clark, I would say, is more austere than like a BMO Harris branch location.
Totally.
Like, it's very regimented. It's, you know, super clean. It's like going through TSA or something.
It has little pretty clouds there's painted on the front.
Are you talking about Clark south of Foster or Clark where?
This is Clark and Grace. Clark, just north of Waveland, Clark and Grace.
Okay.
And it's a couple blocks north of Wrigley Field on Clark.
The Wrigley Weed Shop.
Totally. They may end up calling it that, but right now it's just one of those franchise pot shops. And they seem to be doing pretty well, and I don't know that they're hurting the neighborhood that much. I want to go to Washington, D.C. for a second, guys, and then I'll let you go. The boringest president ever continues to sign executive orders. He doesn't tweet. It's interesting to see how the Republican Party is trying to figure out how much to rally around Donald Trump in the second impeachment. Imagine that. Marjorie Taylor Greene is a QAnon-friendly congresswoman. She's in the U.S. Congress. And a video has surfaced of her tracking down, what's the Hogg kid's first name?
David, I think.
David Hogg. After his school was shut up, he becomes an advocate. There he is in the Capitol, and she's walking behind him, making sure the camera's on her.
And you are using your lobby and the money behind it and the kids to try to take away my Second Amendment rights. Sad. He has nothing to say because he's paid to do this. We saw him inside the Senate building. He had 30 appointments where he went around and got to talk to senators. I got to talk to none. Guess what? I'm a gun owner. I'm an American citizen, and I have nothing but this guy with his George Soros funding. I want you to think about that. And he's a coward. He can't say one word because he can't defend.
Well, if you can't expel someone from Congress for threatening the lives of the people she works with on Capitol Hill through her social media account and some of the disgusting things that she has done, then you can never expel anyone. It takes two-thirds of a vote, two-thirds of the House to expel a member. And it seems to me that it would be smart politics for the Democrats to at least put this to a vote. I doubt they'll get two-thirds of the House to vote to expel her, but you're going to have a lot of Republican congressmen who are going to be put into an awkward position of having to vote in favor of keeping the QAnon loony woman in Congress, and that could come back to hurt them at re-election.
Well, she's only in office for 2 years. You know, I mean, the people knew she was a QAnon-friendly congresswoman when they voted for her. That she says mean things to a teenager, I don't think is a reason to throw her out of Congress. Let her suffer the consequences of that next time she runs for office?
I think it goes back to what I was saying about the union and the mayor. She does not agree on a shared set of facts. Because I worked in California, I tend to follow California politics out of a weird sense of nostalgia. And she also said that she believed that the giant wildfire a year or so, 2 years ago, the campfire was started by a laser that was operated by former Governor Jerry Brown as part of his scheme to build a high-speed rail line across the state, and that he needed that land cleared, so he conspired with a cabal that has a space laser to burn all that down.
So what about that? So what about that, Heather?
Where's the lie? I don't understand.
No, but I mean, they wanted that to represent them. So I just don't think we get it. I don't think we get to weigh in on that. That's their girl. That's what they want.
That's definitely an argument. I mean, I think the other question will be whether she gets to sit on committees. So, for example, we all remember Steve King, who was the admittedly racist and xenophobic congressman from Iowa, who was stripped of his community assignments after he basically said, man, you know, white supremacy, what's so wrong with it? You know, the question is, you know, should she have committee assignments? Should somebody who believes that the Parkland shooting was a false flag to take people's guns sit on the committee that oversees education policy in America? Well, I think that's a larger question.
I worry that we're at a place, though, where if one side doesn't like the other side's tweets or comments or politics, rather than voting against them or letting the voters vote them out, they try and excise them from the conversation. Donald Trump's being impeached a second time. The second time, I think, for better reasons than the first. But I hate to see throwing somebody out or impeaching them as a punitive thing, or punitive is not the right word, but, you know, as a way to just punch back.
I think that at some point when things are coming to light, that I don't think the voters in Georgia knew about some of the things that were being said, that the depths of the lunacy and violence that this woman was supporting. And that now that those have come forward, I think it does seem to me to be legitimate to say, no, this is outside of the guardrails of American politics. We don't want this person in Congress. And if you can get, again, this can't be partisan, because two-thirds is just it's going to require, you know, dozens and dozens of Republican votes. If you can get those votes,
which you won't,
then fine. You probably won't. But then at least you're going to put Republican Congress people on record as saying, well, we don't mind. This is going to be a campaign issue. At least make it a little bit harder.
But see, you're making that sound like your agenda, Eric. You know she can't. You know she would survive. But you want to make it a campaign issue for the Democrats the next time they run against her.
I want to. Yes, because I think that the party itself needs to discourage wing nuts from running, because if this party gets taken over by wing nuts, we're in even more trouble than we are now.
The Republican Party.
I want to jump back on this, because I have friends who are journalists in Georgia, and they knew.
Absolutely.
There was reporting on this, and people knew where she stood on a lot of these issues. She was a Trump supporter. She, you know, she was sort of making up all this stuff about the fake news reports on election results. I mean, they knew what they were getting, you know, even before sort of like lying about, or yeah, I guess I could say lying, not telling the truth about sort of the original impeachment, saying that sort of it was driven by some other sort of left-wing conspiracy, you know, some other left-wing conspiracies. I mean, she's well known as a conspiracy theorist for some time, and the electorate, they knew that. I know not everybody voted for her, but the electorate, the people who supported her, know.
There was national coverage of her, you know, sort of support of QAnon. And she was QAnon before QAnon was really well understood. I mean, she was posting QAnon memes mm-hmm. back in 2017. So this, you know, should not be a surprise to anybody who voted for her. And I think that the preponderance of evidence that we have is that these sort of candidates appeal directly to the base of the Republican Party. And I think that's what somebody like Adam Kinzinger, you know, who's sort of you know, scoping out a post-Trump pro-impeachment vote life, it has to grapple with. But I don't think that we can say that people didn't know. You know, NBC News did a bunch of reporting on her and how she was supporting QAnon. And, you know, before that, her role in the Parkland, you know, sort of, you know, harassing the survivors and the victims' families. There's you know, there's much more than a breadcrumb trail out there.
And right now, as we're speaking, MSNBC is talking to people on the street in Georgia about her and saying that that the media has taken her comments and her Facebook posts out of context.
That's so what the people are saying on the street?
They're doing a man on the street right now. I'm sorry. I'm paying attention to what everyone's saying.
No.
what she meant by a bullet to the head of Nancy Pelosi.
No, I have it on the, yeah.
Yeah.
You guys have so little confidence or faith in the American people.
I don't know if this reporting about her positions was in the primary or the general election, because in general elections, people
She didn't have a Democratic opponent. She won the Republican primary.
Was there a lot of coverage lead up to the primary? Like, this is the laser woman. This is the, and people were saying, yeah, this is what we want.
Yeah. So her Republican opponent was actually, you know, driven from this district because of threats that were made against his family for running against Marjorie Taylor Greene. This is the district that really was the difference between John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock being elected to the United States Senate. You know, voter participation, voter turnout among Republicans in her district dropped precipitously. And the Georgia Secretary of State has said, look, that's what made the difference here. So these, you know, her district knows what they got. They signed up for what they got, and they are not expressing any sort of buyer's remorse.
So if they kick her out, you're saying that they're just going to turn around and elect that guy in the Chewbacca costume from the Capitol. So there's no point in it.
I want to know a little bit more. I still think this is being investigated. I think any of these lawmakers who may have also been part of encouraging the Capitol insurrection, I think, yeah, hold them to account for that. I think that's what we're really getting at. No, is it really about the Facebook post? I think that what she would be held account for is if she had anything to do with that, which some folks think she does.
With the insurrection.
Yes.
Right.
Because if you're going to hold the president to account for this, it seems to be sort of consistent that you would hold some of the lawmakers who might be involved.
Well, I think Eric just wants her out because she's a hateful wingnut, not because maybe we can tie directly the insurrection to her. But I guess that would be another.
I thought that we were talking about sort of tossing her out for maybe disagreeing with some of her commentary.
Right, general nuttiness.
I don't think it's that. I think it's sort of actionable if it's tied to sort of the insurrection, but that all of these QAnon backing comments are sort of, you know, bolstering the case.
You know, the last thing I promised you guys, I just wanted to bounce off of you, was I was reading on CNET and talking to Ian Schur, who's an editor over there, and they were writing about Faces of the Riot. Have you followed this at all? So with all of the video out there of the people in the riot, I'm not sure if it's a Facebook page. I think it's a website, facesoftheriot.something or another. And they've got screen grabs of all of the faces they've been able to isolate that stormed the Capitol. And then they said, help us identify these people. Kind of like they got wrong with the Boston Marathon bombers. But, you know, remember when that was crowdsourced. But they're doing that. They're saying, who are these people? And let's go get them. And there's a really interesting conversation about the efficacy and the ethics of that.
To the efficacy point, my friend sent me a photo of a bus stop in D.C. that had six or nine faces on it.
Yeah.
On a bus stop. And I thought, do they think those people are from D.C.? Why is there D.C. bus stop? I just found that to be odd. Like, there's no way they were from that area.
I think it has to do with the fact that they would be tried in D.C., so that you have to sort of start there to determine. I think it's a procedural issue.
But you're making it sound like it's like, have you seen this person lately? We need to know who they are. Was that the purpose of the bus sign?
Oh, it was a total like a milk kid on a milk carton.
Right. You know, I'm thinking about some of those people in Chicago, the realtor and the guy that was working for that tech company. And there was another couple of people who we know a little bit about. they just must be crapping their pants every day, knowing eventually there will be consequences for this. The cases are being made against them. And we only know about a few from the Chicago area, right? But there must be dozens and dozens from Chicago, big city. But right now, I don't have a lot of sympathy for them. I'm still, every time I see that video, I get re-energized about how awful that was. Anybody recommended reading, viewing, or drinking?
I watched One Night in Miami, the movie, the fictionalized version of an encounter between Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown, and I enjoyed it significantly, even though I usually dislike fictionalized historic works of art. But it was entertaining and thought-provoking.
We're dialed in on Escape to the Chateau on the Peacock Network. English couple buys a chateau in France, fixes it up. Very fun. Very fun.
Watched a rom-com on Netflix called Fisherman's Friend. It's a Fisherman's Friends. It's a movie based on a true life story of some sea shanty singers who became. I'm really into this TikTok sea shanty revival. A lot of readers recommended that I watch it. It's a completely standard rom-com, but with an excellent soundtrack.
I think the kid who started that got a big record deal recently, the sea shanty guy on TikTok. I just watched The Kid Detective, which stars former teen heartthrob Adam Brody. And it's a great new, I would call it a modern noir comedy about a washed up kid detective. And it's really good.
Okay. And Lisa reads
the newspaper.
She reads.
I actually watched Two Popes. I think the whole thing with Biden going to church made me think, well, maybe this will pass for my weekly requirement by watching this movie about the two popes. Actually, kind of fascinating. It's supposed to be loosely based, I guess, on the relationship between Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict, kind of amplifying sort of some of the changes in the church. But it was actually pretty fascinating. As a sometimes Catholic, I thought it was interesting. Yeah. I recommended it. The acting was really great. And I thought the writing was actually very well done, too.
Lisa Donovan, Heather Sharon, Eric Zorn, Austin Bird. Thank you, everybody. Nice to see you all again this week. Stay safe. I'm John Williams. We're produced by LF Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Bye-bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.